UU Quilt to read our volumes of creative and academic writing. Stay tuned for more information about our upcoming launch event. Love, Quilt.
I should unwalk out the door, drag my feet along the floor. Then I see you, you're walking across the campus, cool professor studying romances. How am I supposed to pretend?
Hi, my name is Michelle Li Zhang, and this is my piece, I Tried to Speak Chinese, But. I tried to speak Chinese, but the words fell off my tongue, like the filling from a tongbao skin. Inflections leaking out the sides, spilling broth down my chin. My throat burned, but I swallowed the sound.
Listening to Close Reads on CFRC 101.9 FM. I'm Corey.
And I'm Madeline.
On Close Reads, we share and analyze creative writing by students here at Queen's. Tune in for Close Reads from close by. Today, we'll be talking about I Tried to Speak Chinese But by Michelle Li Zhang, which you just heard, followed by Stew by Cutsleeve. I Tried to Speak Chinese But was published in Quilt Volume 2, Unbelonging.
Michelle Li Zhang is a queer, neurodiverse writer and editor of Chinese Heritage. A recent graduate from Queen's University, Michelle now studies publishing at Centennial College, where they also work as a section editor for the magazine On the Danforth. They are a fan of speculative fiction, experimental prose, and storytelling that blurs the boundaries between what is foreign and familiar, known and unknown, remembered and forgotten. For my analysis, I'm going to just focus on the first two lines of this poem, which are incredibly dense with imagery of the tongbao. For those who haven't had the pleasure of eating tongbao before, they're dumplings filled with soup as well as pork. And they're delicious, one of my favorite foods, but eating them is a learned skill because they're full of liquid. So you basically have to bite a hole in the dumpling skin and then suck out the soup before eating the solid parts of the dumpling itself. So you have to know how to eat tongbao and do so in a specific way. And this is, of course, also true of learning to speak a language, but it's especially the case for a tonal language like Chinese, where the inflections, how you say the word, affect what you say. To return to that first stanza, the words fell off my tongue like the filling from a tongbao skin. The verb fall here gives a sense that the words are sort of sloppily exiting the speaker's mouth, that they're being spoken without intention, falling in whatever form they happen to be in rather than being intentionally formed. And the words are supposed to exit the mouth, so it's fine that they're falling off the tongue. But the simile of the tongbao reverses that image. Food, of course, is supposed to enter the mouth rather than exiting it, so the fall is reframed as a failure to properly eat the tongbao. The tongbao itself is also deconstructed in this simile. We first encounter the filling from a tongbao skin, giving a sense firstly of the meat, literally the literal meat, and particularly the soup, the main substance and content of this tongbao, then the fragile container of the thin skin that's being broken apart for the filling to come out. The word in this stanza is being compared to the filling, but the fact that it's the dumpling wrapper itself, the skin, is implied to be broken or bitten open and then subsequently ignored by the poem perfectly encapsulates the feeling of the speaking of the word. I imagine the tongbao initially whole and symmetrical, and then once it's improperly bitten open, the soup is falling out all over the place, the tongbao is losing its shape, it's sticky and awkward, and you're losing all the delicious broth that gives the tongbao its shape and content. And we can imagine, too, that that's exactly what's happening in the speaker's words. They're being bitten out incorrectly, losing shape through the improper inflections and therefore losing meaning and content. And the messiness of the image of failing to eat the tongbao gives a sense of shame to this failure. And by the way, this is an experience that I have had many times. I don't know what it is about my luck with tongbao, but they do always somehow like stick to the spoon for me. And it makes it a huge pain to eat, even though, to be frank, it should be like a pretty easy food to eat. They're just, you know, returning to the analysis. Even before I hit the second stanza, which actually gets into the nitty gritty of how the broth is falling out of the dumpling, I'm already imagining this sensory experience that the imagery begins to hint at. And obviously, this poem is not a haiku, but I would say that the use of imagery is definitely similar to a haiku sensibility. This incredibly strong image that's dense with meaning in so few words, and an emotional significance that the reader parses out for themselves rather than the connection being described at length in the poem itself. So the image is the thing, and it forces the speaker's sensory experience alongside them so that you feel rather than read the emotional connection that the poem is kind of getting at. And these layers of significance are, I would argue, evocative of a tongbao itself. It's pork surrounded by broth, surrounded by a dumpling skin, and if you approach it correctly, each of the elements of the dumpling work together to produce a tiny object that is dense with taste, which really is the culinary version of literary meaning.
Yeah, and to build off of the kind of the faux pas that you're making about that denseness of meaning, I think the use of the title is also a really interesting way that brings it in. I didn't write this in my script, so Madeline's looking at me confused, but that's okay. I think there's a lot of, some of my favorite poems out there use like the title as the first line. I think this is a really effective use of that to keep it so condensed. And then obviously it remains condensed for all of the reasons that Madeline just beautifully explained. Something I'm interested in is the way that language is made physical. In this poem, I know I've talked about this in a few of our recent episodes, but I am a linguist, so you have to forgive me for kind of fixating on ideas about and portrayals of language in this poetry. But the imagery really makes language into something physical and tangible in the world. Words can fall off your tongue in the same way that filling falls out of a dumpling. Inflections can leak and run down your chin. And this idea of leaking, also gives a sense of a lack of control. You can't help it, and now you're covered in broth and covered in language. This sort of complete immersion in the lack of immersion in the language as it is. Despite the frequency of the metaphor to swallow your words in like everyday speech, the physicality attributed to language in the first few lines that come before swallowing the words, I would argue also makes the language physical here. As well, this is also because it's painful, like it burns the throat on the way down in the poem, but it also remains within the speaker. The language isn't expelled, it is swallowed at the end of the poem. So despite the discomfort with speaking Chinese in the poem, with the spilling, the leaking, the burning that comes with it, there's still a sense that it is within the speaker. It comes from within them and resides within them. So despite this tenuous relationship with language that the rest of the imagery develops, we still get the sort of like connection and sense of the language is coming from the speaker, despite everything else.
Next, we'll be playing Goals by Supernova, followed by an interview with Michelle.
I'm fitting in like a bright green ambulance. I hold it in like softcore violet. Cause I want it. I want it, babe. I want it. For you to see me. I'm making strides towards my goals. Breathe away every last bit of my soul. With my heart in my hands, blood in my throat. 100 panic attacks, about to explode. I'm making strides. Strides towards my goals. Breathe away every last bit of my soul. With my heart in my hands, blood in my throat. 100 panic attacks, about to explode. I'm making strides.
Michelle is now joining us over Zoom to talk about their amazing piece. Michelle, thank you so much for coming in over the internet.
Totally different, a completely different poem. Zoom call.
Thank you so much for coming in to talk about one of my favorite poems of all time. I try to speak Chinese, but.
Oh, thank you guys so much for inviting me. And like, it's an honor to be here. And like, it's an honor to be on your show, which is fantastic, by the way. And also, you cooked with your analysis.
Thank you.
You cooked with the poem. It was fantastic.
And like, also made us hungry. Like, yes. Literally, because of
now we hungry have to, for more we content. Have,
well, I meant like, I want Tung Ba now.
Yeah, but to segue into the analysis, or into the interview, rather. First of all, I wanted to ask about your writing process. This is an incredibly tight, really concise poem. But as we explored earlier on the show, it is an incredibly dense, like, poem meaning-wise. And I wanted to ask how you went about writing this poem. Was it initially any longer than just the, six lines that it is now? Or was it always this concise?
An excellent question. I had to think about this for a while because I was trying to remember when I had first written this poem, actually. And after some time, I managed to remember that I believe I wrote the first draft, which was in second year after I had taken a poetry class with Juliana Cote-Bitec. I think I mentioned this in the previous episode as well. Basically, in that class, Juliana, who is the author of poems such as 100 Days and Gauntlet, she had shown us like a bunch of like really fantastic and very kind of, I guess, unconventional poems, many of them by non-white writers or writers who came from cultures that like don't speak English. And like it kind of really made me rethink, I guess, what a poem can be or what forms that a poem can take. I remember there were poets like Vic Shreya, Dion Brand, and like just being in that class and being able to experience like reading and analyzing these poems that many of them I didn't understand at first, but then as I looked through into it, they really made me think. And I came to like, as I understood them, like my mind kind of like felt like it was expanding. It was kind of just like amazing. And like, so I think that was kind of what inspired me to maybe just kind of spontaneously write this poem one day. And it was always this short. Like, I think it's pretty much unchanged from the first, like the very first time I wrote it. I think what might have changed is maybe the final line. I think I like fiddled with the wording there. But yeah, like I just kind of was struck by this image, I suppose. Because when it comes to tongbao, I love tongbao. And I'm also terrible at eating it, so I can relate to that. It is like so hard to eat. Every time I eat tongbao, I try to pick it up with my chopsticks. I don't know if it's my own chopstick technique, which again kind of ties into the
throwback.
Or the tongbao itself. I don't know, but like I'll eat it and then like it'll just fall apart and I'm like, no, and I'll like the filling will slip out onto my plate and there's so will the soup and I'm like, no.
And it's so sad because like that's the best part.
Yeah, like you just lost the soup. Like that's the thing.
Exactly. It's like when you're eating like a, I don't know, a hard, this is really random, but it's like if you're eating a hard candy, you like swallow it before you taste it.
Yeah.
I was like, I was so mad. So anyway, just like every time I eat tongbao, like that like invariably happens. And I think just something about experiencing the kind of unconventional and also like often very tight, like short poetry in Julianne's class is kind of what led me to suddenly, I guess, write this poem one day. I can't really explain how it happened. It's just like, yeah, like I wrote it and I was like, yeah, it's like this kind of like, it was like a, I guess a moment, a kind of an instant of like conveying that feeling of what it's like to see your tongbao drop onto your plate and you can't eat it anymore.
The profound loss of the broth spilling out.
That's so cool because it was actually like a poem that I read in her when I was in her class last year. Reminded me of a little bit with the like using the title as the first line. I couldn't remember it when you're doing the analysis because it is very, it's Hanif Abdurraqib's When We Were 13, Jeff's father left the needle down on a dirty record before leaving the house one morning and never coming back, which is why I couldn't remember the title of it off the top of my head. That one's a longer poem, but I think it also really has that kind of like dense punch of meaning in each line. And so I think it's cool that it was inspired by that class because it reminded me of a poem from that class. So I think that that does come through. As we've alluded to a little bit, we had you on the show a few weeks ago to talk about your poem Holding Chopsticks, which includes a lot of similar themes to this poem. And I was wondering, like, did you write these at similar times with similar things in mind? Or do you find that this is a theme you often return to? Were they from a similar artistic period? Like, is there a connection between the two?
Yeah, so like when it comes to poetry, and I feel like I tend to not write poetry that often. I think I'm more of like a prose writer, but oftentimes when I write poetry, I find myself writing about cultural experiences, like my personal cultural experiences, my experiences with language and Chinese language, cultural guilt, all that stuff. And so yeah, like I think it's kind of, I guess in some ways it's maybe to be expected that Holding Chopsticks, which is my other poem, tended to go along the same lines.
Yeah.
I believe I had written I tried to speak Chinese, but I think I want to say maybe a year or two before I wrote Holding Chopsticks.
Okay.
So like I tried to speak Chinese, but was like my kind of first poem like about this. And then I think when it came to Holding Chopsticks, if I remember correctly, in that class, it was again like an assignment for class, and I was trying to think to myself like I want to write a poem, but I can't think of any other topic to write about except this one topic which I always write about. And I was like, I've already like, is there something about this that I haven't said yet? Like, is there like I don't know, ground that I haven't tread yet? And so I guess that's kind of eventually what led me to write Holding Chopsticks, because I wanted to kind of write about, I didn't want it to be like a copy or just like rehashing, I suppose, the same things as I tried to speak Chinese, but then also, I guess, in some ways too, like the two poems ended up being also quite similar, like both thematically and also content-wise, because both of them, I guess, kind of deal with food, chopsticks, tongbao, you know?
Yeah.
And like, also, like, I think also too, like, when, I believe it was Corey, you mentioned this in your analysis, about agency. And like, it was really interesting when you brought that up, because like, I think when it comes to a lot of my personal works, I tend to write a lot about agency. Mm-hmm. I don't know, there's like something about agency control that like is kind of something that I feel like I keep returning to as like a motif, I suppose, in my writing. And in both these poems, I'd say agency, this idea of agency or lack thereof, is kind of a prevailing theme. Because with, again, I tried to speak Chinese, but it's this moment of trying to pick up the tongball, trying to like control, I guess, your sensory experience of like eating this, and then you can't. It should be something that you, like, it should, quote unquote, be something that you think you should be able to control, and then you can't. And like, so there's that kind of like lack and like frustration there too, kind of like helplessness as you kind of watch that tongbao fall into your plate uneaten. And then similarly too with holding chopsticks is like, again, this idea of the act of holding chopsticks is something that you control as well, but the fact that I hold it incorrectly and never even realized that it was incorrect until my friend pointed out one day. It's also this kind of feeling like I keep trying to control things, but it doesn't quite come out right.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's kind of the experience I had with my Chinese identity, I guess, is like sometimes like that. Like I keep trying to feel like I'm trying to control, I guess, the way I experience or relate to my own Chineseness, and yet I can't. There's like so many things outside of my control. And so in some ways, I guess my the way I navigate or try to navigate my Chinese identity is just a lot of just reflection, late night overthinking about my own personal agency, about how I speak, how I learn my language, how I experience my culture, which is always kind of inevitably filtered through the Western lens that I grew up in. And so I think that's like in the end these poems did thematically come out quite similar, but I think they managed to say different things, so I'm not happy with that.
I think it was actually, not to make this episode all about Dr. Okopitek, but it was when I was in her class, I found myself returning to, like, for my like final chapbook and with all my writing, it was about the same themes over and over. And she said she it was something along the lines of like, well, the thing you don't want to write about is the one thing you have to write about. And I think that is true of really true of poetry. Like, if you the thing that you're like, no, I don't want to write about that again, like I'm through with it, is the thing that you have to return to.
And I think also that process of reflection, Michelle, that you mentioned, that I think the form of poetry lends itself to really well because of the possibilities for like fragmentation and the lack of, I guess, like linearity almost that the forms and like the multiplicity of forms even of poetry offer. I think it makes it easy to approach similar content from very different angles in terms of the actual process of writing it. Because, I guess it's kind of similar content, but they are different poems and they're different, like, in terms of form, but they're also different in terms of, like, the part of the action that they're talking about. There's, like, the idea of, like, holding the chopsticks in one versus the idea of, like, actually eating the tongbao in the other. So it's, like, it's different points of, I guess, the same action.
And it's cool how much meaning can be pulled from those moments.
From such specific moments as well. The idea of, like, taking that one moment and, like, expanding it so profoundly that, again, like, poetry is the perfect form that you can approach that with. It's also crazy to think that poetry is not your main gig, because again, these poems amazing. But like I try to speak Chinese, but I think about it all the time. I think about it all the time, and it's very, very important to me. But with a question that is a little bit more distance from the text itself, I wanted to ask you about the relationship between food and culture that you articulate so succinctly in this poem and that we've just been discussing as well. Can you talk to me about your relationship with food and how that relates to culture for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So like, this is a fantastic question too, because I feel like it made me like really reflect as well on my own relationship to food and how that is also in some very intimately tied to culture in ways that I think I hadn't previously realized prior to then. So basically when it comes to food, like I've always been like a really picky eater. And like, as like, I guess time went on, that kind of veered into like disordered eating at times as well. And so as I got older too, like I've really kind of realized that like, honestly, my relationship with food is not the best. Like I just struggle with eating it. It's not like I just like have no interest. I rarely feel hunger. I don't like the textures of a lot of food as well, or the taste. And so I feel like that, like in some, like, because I guess, I don't know, there's like so much about culture that is often like tied to food. And it's like, I think in some ways too, my like a kind of poorish relationship to food has also kind of, I think, bled into my connection to my own culture as well. Because when it comes to like a lot of like traditional Chinese foods, there's things like, I guess, like there's like, I don't know, I mentioned I'm from Sichuan, and like I think the other poem. And Sichuan is like a region in China. It's very well known for its spice. Like it's really like, but I can't handle spice at all. Like you give me like one little piece of spice, like I have this other memory that I also read a poem out like many years ago. I had this like, I was in Xi'an one time, which is another place in China, also known for its like spice. I was eating like some noodles and like I had asked for like a no spice in my noodles, and they kind of looked at me, the servers at the restaurant. They were like, we don't have that. And so I just like was like feeding through this like bowl of like what their bland noodles, which were so spicy to me. And I think like that's kind of like summarizes, I guess, my relationship with food and also in consequence, my relationship to like my Chinese heritage, is because like a lot of times it's kind of like sucks because like I cannot, you know, maybe stomach a lot of the foods that I think are traditionally, I guess, Chinese, and like a lot of my, I guess, like safe foods that I can like rely on eating on aren't actually like Chinese in nature. Like I tend to like really like cheese. And, like when I'm like, when I really like struggle with eating like that day, I just kind of go to cheese. And like cheese is like it's not like a Chinese thing. Like my parents didn't even like, they never tasted cheese until they came to Canada, which is a really interesting thing that I found out. And so like, just like something about that, I guess, is maybe perhaps why I find myself returning to the motif of food so often in my works about like Chineseness or my own personal relationship with being Chinese. Just this idea of, I don't like, you know, just food is such a tricky thing, I think, sometimes to navigate. Mm-hmm. And the fact that like the way it's like I am connected and disconnected to it, and the way I'm also connected and disconnected to Chinese culture, the way I struggle with cooking too, and the way, but also the way that like I can, you know, I really want to learn how to make Chinese dishes, but then I'm wondering like, will I be able to eat these later? Mm-hmm. It's a lot of like kind of, you know, interesting ideas like that. And so I just, it's just like these poems, I think, just gave me an outlet to kind of really connect those two and reflect on it. So
that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
Thank you for coming in, and thank you for sharing your work with us. You can read I Tried to Speak Chinese But by Michelle Li Zhang on the Quilt website at queensquilt.ca. This has been Close Reads with Corey and Madeline on CFRC 101.9 FM. To take us out, we'll have Talk Talk by Charlie XCX.
I've been looking at you, putting holes in your head. We've been talking for months, but never in the same room. Now I wanna approach ya, but we've been keeping this a secret. And you're surrounded by friends, and I'm just wondering what they know. I wish you'd talk, talk, wish you'd talk, talk, wish you'd talk, talk, wish you'd just talk to me. I wish you'd talk, talk, wish you'd talk, talk, wish you'd talk, talk, wish you'd just talk to me. I think you're getting closer, cause I've been getting nervous. I wish you'd talk, talk, wish you'd talk, talk, wish you'd talk, talk, wish you'd just talk to me. Talk to me, talk to me. Are you thinking about me? Kinda thinking you are. I followed you to the bathroom, but then I felt crazy. I'm feeling like I'm on fire, cause we've been keeping this a secret. And all your friends are still there, and I'm just wondering what they know. I wish you'd talk, talk, wish you'd talk, talk.
Thank you.
is a literary publication for and by undergraduate students here at Queen's.
If you are interested in the fantastic minds of your peers, check us out on Instagram at QUQuilt to read our volumes of creative and academic writing.
Stay tuned for more information about our upcoming launch event.
Love, Quilt.
I should unwalk out the door, drag my feet along the floor. Then I see you, you're walking across the campus, cool professor studying romances.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, your campus community radio station, broadcasting to you since 1922.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Melodies of Myth, where we explore short historical tales blended with Indian classical and Western music. I'm your host, Simar Kaur, and it's an honor to accompany you on this journey of discovering the rich interweaving of music and history. Together, we will explore the stories, traditions, and timeless melodies that have shaped our understanding of this art form. For today's episode, I have a wonderful playlist for you, and I really hope you enjoy.
Oh. Thank you. मेरे ढोल ना सुन मेरे प्यार की धुन मेरे ढोल ना सुन मेरे ढोल
मेरी धड़कनों में बजती जगती निगाहों में ख्वाहिश तेरी ही सजती है
मेरे ख्याल में हर पल तेरे ख्याल शामिल है
लम्हे जुदाइयों वाले मुश्किल बड़े ही मुश्किल हैं
Wasn't that just magical? First, we had Ghar More Pardesia from Kalank, a song that blends classical Indian music with modern cinematic rondo. Shreya Ghoshal's ethereal voice takes us on a journey of longing, nostalgia, and pride, while the song's intricate Kalank-inspired choreography adds a layer of visual splendor to its storytelling. Oh, I just wish you guys could see this video. With Preetam's masterful composition and Amitabh Bhattacharya's evocative lyrics, it's a beautiful ode to the cultural richness of India. And then, Mere Dholana from Bhool Bhulaiya, what a powerhouse of melody and rhythm. Shreya Ghoshal and M.G. Shrikumar's vocal magic creates an intoxicating blend of Carnatic and Hindustani classical styles. This song is a celebration of devotion, tradition, and virtuosity. Perfectly paired with Vidya Balan's unforgettable dance performance in the film. It's the kind of track that demands your attention and leaves your heart racing. Two extraordinary songs, each showcasing the timeless charm of Indian classical music while bridging it with contemporary storytelling. What do you think, listeners? Which one stole your heart tonight? Alright guys, and before we head back to our music, here is a short PSA from the TEDx Queens U Club. They say, get ready for 2025. Join hundreds of curious minds at Queens University for a day filled with inspiring talks, thought-provoking ideas, and transformative conversations. TEDx Queens U is one of Canada's largest student-led TEDx events, where speakers from diverse backgrounds take the stage to share ideas that challenge and inspire. Stay tuned for more details on tickets and programming by visiting TEDx Queens U on Instagram. TEDx Queens U 2025 is also calling for sponsors. If you have an idea worth sharing, this is your chance to take the stage in front of hundreds of curious minds at one of Canada's largest student-led TEDx events. Together, we can amplify innovative ideas and create an unforgettable experience. Interested in sponsoring? Email us at sponsors@tedxqueensu.ca for more details. Alright, picture this. It's the 1930s and a young Indian dancer, armed with nothing but his talent, sets sail across the world. His mission? To introduce the West to the beauty of Indian classical music. But here is the twist. the audience had no idea what was coming. So this young man, let's just say he was bold, steps off the ship, surveys the crowd, and realizes that they're staring at him like he just landed from another planet. But did he let that stop him? Of course not. He took the stage, ready to rock their world. And when the first notes of music filled the air, the crowd was stunned. You see, they weren't just watching a performance. They were experiencing something completely new. Something so mesmerizing, they couldn't help but get hooked. Fast forward to the 1960s. At Expo 67 in Montreal, the world saw Indian classical music in full force. Legendary artists like Ravi Shankar performed, captivating the crowds with their music. These performances didn't just entertain, they opened doors to a whole new world of sound and culture. The 1980s and 90s saw more excitement. Schools like York University and the University of Toronto started offering courses in Indian music, making it part of their mainstream Canadian education. Indian classical music wasn't just being performed, it was now being taught to a whole new generation of students, both Indian and non-Indian alike. And it did not just stop there. Across Canada, cultural organizations and community groups began to host concerts, workshops, and events that introduced even more Canadians to the magic of Indian music. And as musicians became more involved, they started collaborating with artists from India, creating a blend of East and West that continues to shape the music scene even today. So, the next time you hear the deep soothing sounds of a sitar or the vibrant beats of the tabla, know that Indian classical music has a long, rich history in Canada. A history shaped by passionate artists, cultural exchange, and the open hearts of Canadians who welcomed it with open arms.
Tune in Sundays at 11 p.m. for Orchestral Maneuvers After Dark with me, DJ Squared. Each episode features a great mix of new and vintage, Canadian and international, new wave, punk, post-punk, garage rock, pop, electronica, ambient, and even the occasional remix. Sweet beats are in store for all to enjoy. Join in the fun, OMD, every Sunday at 11 right here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Cold weather getting you down? Warm up this season with amazing hot food to go at Old Farm Fine Foods. Pizza, frittata, sausage rolls, sandwiches, soups, and more are ready and waiting to get in your belly. Plus, you can also buy fresh and frozen foods to prepare at home and enjoy a huge selection of meats, cheeses, produce, coffee, beverages, and condiments. Pop into the shop Monday through Saturday between 8 and 5 at 204 Berry Street in downtown Kingston. And don't forget to follow Old Farm Fine Foods on Instagram at OldFarmFF to get the scoop on the latest goodies. Old Farm Fine Foods, comfort food you can count on.
This ain't Monkey Wrench by Foo Fighters. This isn't actually an ad for my new show. You want to join me, Zach, every Saturday at 8 p.m. for your favorite 90s hits, throwbacks, and deep cuts. We'll be playing you songs like this all night from 8 to 9.